Jamie's peeing, everybody. We're recording this episode from my very modest home theater that I made over the last year. Just put the finishing touches on it a few weeks ago. We were going to record in my normal virtual recording studio space, and I didn't want to be crammed into a walk-in closet in, you know, 80-degree weather with Jamie for 2 hours. So instead, we're making this work. Between the screen and the curtains that I have up, it kind of does some of the baffling work, and it's absorbing a lot of the sound. But the important thing is that I didn't have to be in a walk-in closet with no air conditioning, sitting, you know, face-to-face with Jamie for 2 hours. And that is why we're doing this. Jamie has concluded urinating. He has washed his hands, did not use soap, and...
I did use soap.
That was really fast. You didn't do 20 seconds. I didn't hear no happy birthday twice. Yeah, he's sitting back down. All right, here we go.
We're introducing the show, right?
This is a proper introduction.
A proper introduction. Yeah. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
This is our first in-person recording, and we're both very uncomfortable.
It's pretty weird.
I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott. I'm uncomfortable. I am the movie guy. Also that.
This is a podcast about pairing wine with movies. We are exploring, finding, mining for synesthesia between the two.
Fabricating.
And hopefully you don't find it nauseating and navel-gazing. Navel-gazy, navel-gaze-ish.
Navel-gazy.
Navel-gazy.
Yeah. Concerned with the navel gaze, not the white gaze or the male gaze,
but the navel gaze.
So today, Jamie, today.
Today. Well, you start with today, because you picked this damn movie.
Well, so today, continuing our brief mini-series on some of the overlooked movies of the overlooked year 2020, the year that wasn't, we are discussing one of my favorites of last year, Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga. A Netflix original film about the extremely famous and enormously popular everywhere on the, you know, Western world, except for this country, pop song writing and performing contest. This one stars Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams, directed by journeyman director David Dobkin, and it's a big, goofy, silly comedy. I told you that this movie was unexpectedly sweet, that it is warm, that it has infectious enthusiasm, and to really prime the pump for, like, tonally what Jamie was getting into, I told him that to pair it, he should think of Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow.
And boy, are you correct. This movie is Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow.
It is that.
I expressed on our last episode, as we were doing the next week on, that maybe I undershot Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow with this wine. But we'll get into that and the possible misfire that it may have been when we talk about the wine and or the pairing. But for this wine, I chose Clos Julien Chardonnay, coming from Price Canyon, San Luis Obispo County.
This is a California wine.
It is a California
Price
wine.
Price
Cali. Yeah, so I chose the wine because I have, like, really warm memories of this wine. It's, once again, available at Moore Brothers Wine Company, which for me, living in Philadelphia, is right across the bridge. It's like an 11-minute trip from my house in South Philly. And it's a $16 bottle of delicious Chardonnay. So you said Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow, and I think I may have just been recalling times that I drank this wine and not the wine itself.
Yeah, are there any Chardonnays that are Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow?
No.
We're going to get into it later, I'm sure, and you'll be flagellating yourself a lot, but... Like, are there any wines that are Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow? This sounds like that sounds like something that you order at a frat party, right?
I could absolutely find a wine, probably a natural wine, probably a Pet Nat. You remember
a ton of sugar?
The Pet Nat that we did for the Oscars?
Yeah,
was a little bit the Glitter Chilean Bomb Candy one. Rainbow.
It was
coming close.
It was Candy Rainbow, but not Glitter Bomb.
Right.
But it was Candy Rainbow.
For sure. And I feel like we could find something that is Glitter Bomb. Maybe not both. Maybe those are mutually exclusive things in the wine world.
Yeah, because it needs to be like mega fruity.
Yeah.
To be Candy Rainbow. But then Glitter Bomb, I would have thought bubbles.
Right.
But there's no bubbles in this.
No bubbles here. And there probably should be. And you definitely don't want like a refined traditional method bubble like champagne. That's not glitter bomb.
Huh. This is not very sweet.
This is not sweet at all. I think I just ignored unexpectedly.
You just ignored that. That's good. But so Eurovision.
This movie rules.
It's really good. It's super good. It's better than you think it's going to be. It's nicer than you think it's going to be.
And this is a 2020 release. It was
June 2020, yeah.
Oh, God, June.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie got swallowed up by the zeitgeist, so to speak.
Huh? I mean, it had its moment. Like, it was discussed, and there was a lot of talk, and according to Netflix, 70 million people watched it the first weekend, because that's what they always say. It's always 70 million people watch something. We'll see. We'll see what happens now that theaters are reopening. My local art house theater is reopening. The theaters that I used to run are reopening. We'll see. We'll see what happens to the movies. We'll see if the movie conversation, like, comes back and changes in some way. This movie, like, it was a Netflix movie, so it was always going to primarily be seen online, but fucking comedy like this should have played in theaters.
This
should have played to packed houses. I guess we should do some table setting and just, like, lay out the plot. The plot of the movie is, I was thinking about it the other day, it's kind of a Rocky movie. Like, it's sort of a sports movie where the sport is, like...
Is Eurovision.
Eurovision, it's yeah. It's major, like, pop star song contest. So, Will Ferrell plays Lars Eriksson. Rachel McAdams plays...
Isn't it Eric Song?
Eric Song, but pronounced Eriksson. Rachel McAdams plays Sigrid, Eric's daughter. A very clever joke that they never hammer home too much.
They don't hammer it at all.
But yeah, they are best friends since childhood, and he has long been obsessed with winning the International Eurovision Song Contest, and so they have formed a band called Fire Saga, and like it's like a music comedy, so they suck, but they don't really suck, right? Like they're disastrous performers and they're absurd comedy characters, but like the music is still very good and the songs are well written.
Correct.
Like the songwriting is not why they're not successful. It's because like they keep lighting their costumes on fire, and because he's a disaster,
and because yeah, he can't get to stage at the right time ever.
But so they, through bizarre and Machiavellian and supernatural circumstances, end up accidentally being Iceland's official, like, nominees or representatives at this year's, or I think it was supposed to, I think it's technically 2020. I don't know if they give it a date or not. But so they end up going to the Eurovision semifinals. There's a lot of plot. There's a lot of subplots. There's a romantic tension between them that Sigrid thinks will, once they, if they actually win Eurovision, they'll finally be able to get together. And he becomes jealous of this incredibly flamboyant Russian performer, Lemtov. What's his first name?
Alexander Lemtov.
Alexander Lemtov, played incredibly by Dan Stevens.
So good.
The thing about the movie that's most important is that when you hear Will Ferrell Eurovision comedy, you just assume that it's going to be this mean-spirited mockery and parody. And it's not parody at all. It comes from a very sincere place of love. Honestly, like, you could take Will Ferrell out of it and put, like, maybe a less flamboyant, like, comedic performer, and, like, the bones of the movie are still really strong.
Absolutely.
So the origins of the project, it comes from Ferrell. For almost 20 years, he has held the film rights to make a Eurovision movie.
Seriously?
Yeah. So his wife is Swedish, and she's the one who introduced him to the Eurovision Song Contest. He fell in love. He has attended several times. They did some filming for this movie at the 2019 Eurovision, which was in Tel Aviv, and they shot a bunch of scenes with, like, the crowd, just so they could get the arena with 20,000 people in it. And when they went, David Dobkin was telling this story. He said, you know, we get there, and, like, everybody knows Will, not because he's famous, but because he attends every year, and, like, all of the, like, performers and administrators know him.
That's so good.
But so, yeah, he'd been holding on to the rights forever, and he wrote a script with one of his SNL writing partners, Andrew Steele, which seemingly, like, no American studio wanted to touch because there's no brand name recognition for Eurovision in this country. I feel like that's been changing the last few years. The first time I heard of it, I feel like was on a podcast or on Twitter or something like 4 or 5 years ago, and it's kind of growing with awareness in the US.
Yeah.
But so it's a Netflix movie. They made it. They, you know, they're thinking about a global audience. And then David Dobkin, the director, is like this journeyman filmmaker guy. This is probably the first movie that we've covered that's not like an auteur filmmaker, like somebody with a signature style or vibe, or who is considered like the undisputed author of the movie, right?
I have a question before you move on with Dobkin. I hear movie people describe directors and actors with the word journeyman.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
The fuck do y'all mean by that?
It's a term that I use without 100% knowing what it means. All right,
now what you're saying is you just got called out.
No. So a journeyman director is someone who, like, they don't have a clear career path. Journeyman might be used somewhat interchangeably with, like, a hired hand, like somebody who comes in and they work jobs. Maybe they do comedies, maybe they do dramas, maybe they work in TV for a while. Like, they have a big indie breakout hit that clearly defines their identity, and then the second feature is the sophomore thing that confirms it. It's not a clean narrative as a filmmaker. There's nothing about this that screams a David Dobkin movie to me, having seen a handful of his movies.
Right. My only interaction with the word journeyman has been in, like, fantasy video games that I've played, where, like, if you acquire a skill and you start at, like, novice,
and then you work move up on to journeyman.
Apprentice, journeyman, expert, master.
Yeah.
It's like Elder Scrolls does that shit.
Oh, okay. But I certainly don't mean it pejoratively. But he is, like, his skill set as a director seemingly is not about, I don't know. He doesn't seem like a guy with vision. I don't mean to, like, dig him at all. He started with Tupac videos. Like, out of film school, he started making music videos.
Some of those Tupac videos are real good.
I've never seen any. But yeah, so he started with music videos. He directed a little indie with Vince Vaughn a million years ago called Clay Pigeons. But the thing he's probably best known for is Wedding Crashers. He directed Wedding Crashers.
We've all seen Wedding Crashers.
Right. And Wedding Crashers is fine. The first half hour is great.
The first half hour is so good. And then it forgets
to be a comedy. It just forgets the funny. Yeah. 100%. But so yeah, Dobkin, not a guy who's really on my radar. The last thing he directed was The Judge, which was like Robert Downey Jr.'s, like, I can still do dramatic movies and make $50 million a pop to play Iron Man. Where, like, he's a guy who comes back to his hometown where he's a lawyer and his father is Robert Duvall and he's a judge and there's some kind of incest subplot or something. I don't know. It was supposed to be extremely not good.
Not even conscious of this as a thing.
Yeah. But yeah, Dobkin came on to this movie fairly late in the game, and he said his biggest contribution at the script level was working on Sigrid's arc and the dramatic bones. He said that basically, like, the funny and the structure was already in place. And that's the thing that I find so surprising and resonant about that movie, is that, like it's a good comedy, but you could also take the same structure and all the same characters of this movie and basically play it straight. Yeah. Like, it's kind of hard to play anything straight with how absurdist Eurovision is. Like, the thing itself is seemingly beyond parody.
So I think that this sort of lighthearted comedy is exactly the direction to go with it.
Yeah, the tone is really specific, because it oscillates between extremely silly and broad and slapsticky and borderline fantastical.
Yeah.
Especially with, like, the really intense musical numbers or some of the physical comedy. But then, like, the heart of it is really solid, and the character work is super fucking good. And the script is so tight that, like, we were talking about it earlier. Like, I've seen it twice. You've seen it a couple of times now. And the ending makes me cry every time.
I swear to God, that last, when Will Ferrell gets on stage and begins playing a song that she wrote instead of the song that they're supposed to perform, right, which we know will get them disqualified, but it's fine because it's a character moment.
Yeah.
And that song, I made fun of you the other day for saying it out loud, but also makes me cry.
Yeah.
When it's unreal.
The song is Husavik, or My Hometown, which is the song, the big climactic, like, you know, banger of a ballad at the end of the movie. It's the one that they were nominated for an Oscar for. Didn't win. I have jokingly been saying for months that they should have nominated Ya Ya Ding Dong, which would have been amazing. But watching it a couple times, I actually really think, I think that My Hometown is, like, is the song. The vocal performance is exquisite, and I think the songwriting is good. When she hits the Spjerg note, like the soul note, it's a sound you've never heard a human voice make before. And, like, I think musically it gets you to a place emotionally where, just, like, even just describing it, I'm getting, like goosebumps.
And it's so absurd to think about that from such a kind of silly movie.
It's extremely silly, but it's, like, they do the hard work. It's something that I don't see in a lot of contemporary comedies, which, like, don't really get made at the studio level. David Dobkin talked about it in a couple of interviews where, like, he basically just had to resign himself to the idea that, like, not just with this movie, but with comedies in general, like, if you're not doing an action comedy or a visual effects driven comedy or some kind of franchise comedy, it's not going to get seen in theaters.
Right.
Like, Netflix is one of the only people who are actually making, like, low to medium budget comedies. And while they'll put things out in theaters in like a, you know, limited set, it's mostly just Netflix releasing. He was talking about the loss of the theatrical experience. And Dobkin said when they did their first test screening with a real audience, he said, "I leaned over to my editor at one point because people were laughing so hard that they missed the next joke. I leaned over and I gave a note that I'd given 24 times in my career to my editor. I said, 'Hey, we got to open up that joke. Let's put a couple reaction shots before we come to that next line so they can hear it.' My editor looked at me and said, 'There's going to be like 4 people in a living room. They'll hear the line.'"
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not wrong, but also...
He took that to heart so much and was so disappointed by it. And I actually love this story, that at the next test screening, Dobkin invited Rachel McAdams to come out. And he's like, "Hey, you've never played a like straight down the center, broad comedic character like this before. The movie is not going to play in theaters. You should come to a test screening and hear how an audience responds to your performance."
That's so cool.
And she was like grateful because she's so fucking funny.
She's hysterical.
That's the other way that it jukes expectations. You're like, "Oh, well, this is going to be like a really silly Will Ferrell broad comedy." She is just as fucking silly as he is. His character is dumber, but she is just as silly as he is.
Agreed.
Oh, but the thing about the ending that gets me and that makes me cry every time, it's not just that the song is great, it's the screenwriting of it. Building up to that performance, there are several subplots that get a bow tied on them and wrapped up. But mm-hmm. then just from the time that he walks on stage or even like him backstage, it's like it's just payoff after payoff after payoff after payoff. You pay off his tension and distrust of Lemtov with their argument backstage. Lars and Sigrid basically reconcile on stage. He apologizes to her on stage. He plays her song, which means he has done something selfless and gives up his own dream.
Yep.
So that her song can be played, because he knows that she will sing better, because they've talked already about how like she's holding something back by not singing her own music.
And also by singing in Icelandic.
And then she switches and sings in Icelandic, which then makes the whole town melt. Like, we cut back to her mom and his dad in the bar or the bureaucrats who like picked them to go and represent Iceland. And everybody's just like, it's just 7 or 8 major emotional beats all in the course of the song. And then she hits the damn Spjörg note, like, of course I'm gonna cry.
One of the things that I really love, just a small drop-in that happens consistently throughout the movie, anytime anyone is getting drinks, the only person on screen who gets drinks is Sigrid, and she gets handed 2 glasses every single time. What it read to me by the end as Lemtov is handing her 2 drinks was that he thinks that it's her preference
to always have 2 drinks.
Yeah. Which I think is hysterical.
Yeah. God, Lemtov is amazing.
And he's an incredible character because he's the villain.
Yeah.
But then by the end, like, that gets tied up in a bow. And no, he's gay, and he's not allowed to be gay because he's Russian.
Yeah.
And that's why he's pursuing a woman.
Yeah. So he can have cover. It would be good for him professionally, and she could be a beard for him.
Exactly.
Yeah, and but it would be good for her professionally, too. I love that he's not a villain.
He's not at all a villain.
He's set up, and he's so cartoonish that you think he's going to be, like, the super flamboyant, sexy guy who's going to sweep her away from Lars. Right. And that's how Lars perceives him. And everybody else in the movie knows that he's gay.
Yep.
Like, from the word go. And he's, like, He manipulates, right? Like, he has, I forget her name, the other...
Mita.
The Greek woman. Yeah, the other contestant. He has her, like, basically run interference with Lars so he can get her away, but he doesn't seduce Sigrid or anything. He just wants to, like, "Hey, what if we did this and we make, you know, we work together? You're beautiful. I'm wealthy." I have no Russian accent.
That's
whatsoever.
A really, really bad accent.
Yeah, it was extremely bad. It was nothing. And Niko Bellic, my cousin. That's all I've got. I've got Eastern
got
European
Grand Theft Auto
Soviet
5.
Block from Grand Theft Auto 4.
Whatever. Grand Theft Auto. Yeah, there's a ton of like little things, and the character of Mita could have been nothing.
Yeah, but she's given the time. She's given the screen time, and
yeah, and
she
comes
gets to make
and,
decisions.
Like, tells Sigrid that she didn't actually have sex with Lars, and then like by the end, she just kind of wants to hang out with Lemtov.
Yeah, they just want to be pals. And they're going to go off and, you know, have a lot of sex with different people together. Or separately.
Separately.
Yeah.
Likely separately.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Who knows? They're European.
But yeah, it's just, it just works. And it's loaded with payoffs. And the soundtrack is outstanding. There's not a song on it that I would skip. Even like a song that you think is kind of a goofy throwaway. Like every time I've watched the movie,
yeah.
I forget the name of the group. The song is Chillin' With My Homies.
It's Coolin' With Coolin, the Homies.
Coolin' With My Homies,
by
which
Johnny John John is the John is the John. Name of that character.
So the way it's presented in the movie, it's borderline parody, like a joke song, this like in the way that like a lot of the European pop music in the movie just feels like these 21st century like digitized spins on like American 80s music. But that feels very much like Europe's 21st century version of like Will Smith and Jazzy Jeff, where it's like yes. safe for kids,
yep.
but they don't know what to rap about. But the actual fucking song is great.
It's great.
The beats are great. Like, it's terrific. The choreography. Vocal performance is great. The choreography where they're all in, like, bright colors so, and, like, yeah.
And the, so much fun. The metal song, too. I don't remember the name of that one, but, like...
With a guy who's, like, covered in bones and they're yeah. all, like, graveyard monsters.
The whole thing is great. Okay, we're just, like,
we're just,
talking...
We're just
circles.
Talking we're about... Just... Well, I have one last thing about the movie.
Okay.
I've been thinking a lot about alternate universes, alternate movie universes.
Okay.
Like parallel universes, like, but where like you could be movie God. This is a thing Drew McQueenie used to do on his old website, where like, if you could be movie God and change one thing, what would you change? And like,
okay,
I would
you
like
have
to
explain this to me, yeah. but you're going to need to explain it to the people out
For
there.
For example, I would love, we were just talking about this earlier. I would like to live in a universe where Edgar Wright made his Ant-Man movie, right?
Yes.
For example, I would like to live in a universe where Master and Commander was a huge hit and they made 20 movies in that series, right? Shit like that. I would like to live in a world where this was a sports movie franchise where it was like Rocky movies. You could watch 5 movies that you could get out of this just with these two characters and the general setting of Eurovision. And you up the stakes every time.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be in.
Yeah, so like the second one has to be like Rocky 2, where like this time Lars goes back and he wants to win it for himself this time.
Right.
But then Sigrid, maybe she's off on like a global tour because she's now a huge pop star. But maybe Fire Saga is breaking up and maybe now Lars has to, because like Rocky 2 is it's the same fight, but this time he wins.
Right.
So like while Lars is doing that and getting lost and he's like, I don't know, Kurt's going up the river in Apocalypse Now and like becomes really obsessed. Sigrid's got her own like professional things going on, but then it has to end in like some kind of small earned way. Then you bring in like a different director every time and you can do different tones and reinvent it and just get like really fucking weird and granular and specific.
I would be in for every single one of those movies. Everyone. Oh my God, it would be so much fun. It'll never, ever happen.
No.
But oh my God, that would be a blast.
Yeah. Would be extremely cool. Would watch. Would enjoy.
Okay, should we talk about wine?
I feel like we should talk about this wine.
As I mentioned earlier, I chose because I've got a lot of fond memories with this wine. It's a very inexpensive Chardonnay, and I love Chardonnay. And one of the problems with Chardonnay is that it tends to be very expensive. Like, the really good ones are hard to find and are very expensive. The real estate of, like, top vineyards in Burgundy tend to be on the very high end. It's hard to find an affordable Chardonnay that hits at this level. I think this wine is really, really good without requiring a huge amount of thought.
So this is not a thoughtful wine?
No.
Is it, it's like medium minus thoughtful? I think it's a little bit thoughtful.
I wouldn't call it thoughtless. Like, thoughtful wouldn't be in the first 15 words that I would say about this wine.
Okay, what are the first 15 words? Go.
God, I fucking hate you. Well, I've got a couple here that I wrote down, my tasting notes. Lemon pith.
Lemon pith?
Pith.
All right, what is the difference in flavor between the pith and the... I guess there's a lot of parts of the lemon that have different flavor.
So you've got the zest is its own particular thing, which is like lemon oil.
Okay.
The pith is the white part that is mostly bitter, but carries like a bunch of the lemon flavor.
Okay.
And then the flesh of the lemon has its own like high acid. And then if you juice it and just have the juice, that to me is a different flavor altogether.
Okay. But this is pith. You're getting pith.
Yeah, that bitterness. Crab apple. I'm still on that sort of bitter note of this wine. The crab apple has that sort of bitter astringency to it.
It's been a while since I've eaten a crab apple, I think.
Probably since you were a child.
Since I was a child at summer camp. And like, I don't know, we used to whip crab apples at each other and then maybe one of them hit me in the mouth or something.
Yeah. Underripe yellow apple. We were talking about this earlier. Green underripe banana.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a greenness to this wine. Sea breeze. There's a little salinity.
Sea breeze.
Yeah.
Sea breeze. That's good.
Your wife was the first one to say sea breeze or ocean. And she told me that before I had opened the bottle to drink with this movie. And I totally agree.
I concur on sea breeze.
I think this wine has a softer structure. It's not particularly high acid, despite the fact that there is acidity to it. It has a more silky texture to it. And my last flavor note, which I got like towards the end of the movie, was underripe pineapple.
Ah, well, I mean, look, we're shaking up our order here. So let me just dive right into my notes. So I'm reading these notes out of a recently purchased Wine Folly tasting journal, which I only felt obligated to get since, like, not that we're making a nickel off this show, but like, nope. I've been dining out on that lady's brand for a little while, at least in my own mind, so I could at least throw her a little bit of money. But it's a very nice journal, $25, winefolly.com, very handsome, and it just helped me organize my little notes. But so for smell on the old schnuffer, I was getting pineapple, and I will confess, for the first time ever, I was looking at Wine Folly while taking my notes here. I think I may do that occasionally in the future because I'm very suggestible, but like I was seeing things and I would never have identified the smell of vanilla or almond had I not been reading the words, but it helped me like crystallize something that I was sniffing.
It helps in the early days, I think, to have some suggestibility and what's the word?
Vocabulary.
Vocabulary is important. Yeah. Sometimes you just need a little help.
You can smell the thing and taste the thing, but it doesn't mean you can describe it. Sugar. I was also getting the smell of sugar.
Like Domino's sugar?
Like granulated sugar. Yeah. And I went back several times to make sure, and I was still getting that. Smell of sugar.
It's an interesting note for this wine.
I thought originally I was getting confused and I was smelling it because I was getting like vanilla and like baking notes, and I thought maybe there were just wires crossed, but yeah, I'm still getting sugar. And then for taste, lemon. I'm not so specific as to say pith, but lemon, pineapple, green apple on the finish. That was how I was describing the bitterness. And then like a green bell pepper.
Right. Green bell pepper and vanilla, I would disagree with.
Mm.
Generally, like, not that they're not there for you, but I don't get them. And the issue that I have with them is that they are indicators of specific things that are distinctly not this wine.
Okay.
Vanilla is an indicator of oak usage, which there is none of.
This is not oaked. I was trying to ascertain that, and they didn't say on the bottle.
This is not oak.
Not oak. So this is steel or some other wood? Yeah. Steel. Okay.
And then green bell pepper is an indicator of grapes in the Sauvignon family. Mm-hmm. So Sauvignon Blanc specifically in this case, which this obviously is not.
Right.
But I do agree that there's something green about the wine. And I was struggling to pin it down when I was tasting last night with the movie. And I landed on green banana peel and that underripe pineapple thing. Yeah. To describe it.
I don't think I've had enough pineapple to say underripe or not. But green banana peel, 100% there, especially on the smell.
All right, so a couple of things about this wine that are confusing. I guess I'll start with the things that are not confusing.
Okay, what is not confusing about it?
The wine comes from a vineyard in the central coast of California, specifically in San Luis Obispo County.
Not confusing.
Not confusing.
Right.
The vineyard is called the Spanish Springs Vineyard. It is 1.5 miles from the coast. Very, very coastal influenced. It is a cool climate site. It is planted to, in addition to Chardonnay, Albarino, Barbera, Grenache, Pinot Gris, Pinot Noir, Syrah, and Viognier. It is a 95-acre vineyard. It's pretty large. And it is farmed... one can say sustainable. It is SIP certified, which stands for Sustainability in Practice. It's a certification that has its roots in Sonoma, and it is based around the following 7 tenets.
This is not the same as biodynamic.
No.
Biodynamic, let's see if I remember from last time. Biodynamic is about being a self-contained ecosystem.
Correct.
Right? Your manure comes from the farm and your soil, and you don't bring anything in that didn't come from your farm.
That's right. And then also the mysticism part.
Right. And then the stupid mysticism part.
That's right.
Which is dumb. Yep. So what is this? This is SIPS, which is a different...
SIP, just S-I-P, SIP certified. So they have 7 tenets. Social responsibility, water management, safe pest management, energy efficiency, habitat, business, always evolving. And there are several, like, criteria under each of those things. this was an effort by the Sonoma County growers to codify their own perspective on sustainability. In the years since, Sonoma is actually 100% certified sustainable.
Wow.
As far as all of its
wine. The whole county?
The whole county.
How much wine comes from Sonoma?
A fair bit, but not as much as you would think. The thing that we forget is, like, we talk about the fine wine regions, but most wine that gets made and purchased is bulk wine, and that all comes from the Central Valley of California, the San Joaquin Valley, where it's very hot, very flat, very shitty grapes and shitty agriculture.
And they make lots of wine there.
That's where Two Buck Chuck comes from.
I don't know that I'm familiar with Two Buck Chuck.
Two Buck Chuck is the Trader Joe's brand.
Oh, wow.
Of wine that...
But is it actually a $2 bottle of wine?
It was at one point.
Okay,
It is now, I think, like $8 or something like that. Anyway, Central Valley is where most of the wine comes from. Sonoma is good for quality wine, but as we've said previously, lower yields equal higher quality. So, yeah. Like, your garbage wine is always going to be higher in proportion, volume-wise. All right, so... Here's where we run into what confused me about
this wine. Yeah, what could be confusing about this wine? Except for the absence of any kind of Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow.
There's no Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow.
Which is not the fault of the winemaker.
No, that's my fault.
Right.
I take full responsibility for that.
Well, that would be a first.
Okay, so what confused me about this wine,
yes.
Clos Julien, the producer, they basically have zero online presence. There is nothing about them on the internet.
Okay.
Except for, like, photos of the bottles and tasting notes on, like, Wine Searcher and Vivino.
Okay.
They don't have a social media. They don't have a website. They don't have anything.
That must make it hard to do business and exist in the world in 2021, the year of our Lord, unholy Satan.
Yeah. I tried to run down some information and... That was the one fully unanswered question, was who the fuck is Clos Julien?
Right.
I still have no idea.
So you don't know who makes this wine?
No, I do not. I know
that's the name that's on the label.
I ran down an address.
Okay.
And the address is right next door to another winery that I am aware of, that I've tasted wine from, that makes good wine, called Tally Vineyards.
Okay.
In Arroyo Grande, which is not far from where this is. So it's possible that Tally produces this wine and just puts this different label on it for different distribution channels.
Okay.
That's possible.
But that's a wild and baseless speculation.
Correct. I tried chasing it down, and I actually have a couple of emails out asking that question.
Who makes this wine?
Because I did get in contact with the vineyard owner. And I was able to do that by finding other producers that make wine from this vineyard and running down like a little bit of information. One of the claims that I found was that this vineyard was planted right next to a housing development and that the original intent was that the vineyard would basically just be for residents to make wine at home if they wanted to.
Oh, that's like some rich people shit.
As an amenity. Well, yeah. I mean, we're talking, this is literally next door to Pismo Beach.
That's not impressive.
It's a famous California beach destination.
All right.
That helped me find the vineyard owner because it is in fact owned by the housing developer.
Okay.
However, when I was referred by the owner to the vineyard management team, they told me that there's no way that the amount of homes in that area could possibly use up the grapes from 95 acres of vines.
But so the vineyard doesn't know who they're selling it to? The vineyard doesn't know who's making the wine?
Literally, I spoke to the guys who are managing the sales of the grapes.
Okay.
And they do not work with a winery called Clos Julien. So either these grapes are being sold to a winery who then put a different label on it.
Right.
Or whoever is making this into wine is selling off that finished wine bulk and it's then being bottled by someone else under this label.
Does this happen a lot?
Yes.
Okay. So this isn't like a dark, mysterious secret.
No.
This is probably not a cover-up.
No. absolutely not a cover-up. It's just weird that there's no
presence
online
at all.
Presence. The other thing that I thought about, and I meant to contact Moore Brothers, is that this is a private label for Moore Brothers.
But we don't know.
We don't know.
So we shouldn't speculate.
It would be commensurate with like the lower price point. That would make some amount of sense.
Why Moore Brothers is the first thing that comes up when you Google search Clos Julien.
Right.
But I also have been to Moore Brothers plenty of times, and that's probably
part of the algorithm.
The algorithm feeding me back.
It knows your location too.
Right.
So it is close by Moore Brothers.
So there is not actually a winery called Clos Julien. This is just a label.
There's a winery registered with the TTB called Clos Julien, but
what is a TTB?
The tax and something bureau.
Okay.
It's the one that regulates labeling in the United States.
Okay.
It could be what's called an alternating proprietorship, where like if I were to ever make wine, I wouldn't like build my own winery. I would create a label and pay a custom crush fee with someone that I trust in order to make that wine. But on the label, it would say whatever the name of my winery is.
Yeah.
And it would say produced and bottled at this winery. Legally, it's like a weird thing that happens.
Okay.
So best guess, this is a Moore Brothers private label, but it's super duper yummy.
Yeah, it's mega lums. I like it a lot.
And the vineyard is, by all accounts, like incredibly well managed and is very desirable for producers in the area. I found a number of different producers that make wine from this vineyard. In fact, the company that does the management is using this vineyard as a specific example in their petition to create a new AVA.
Oh.
Because this wine actually... On the label, it says Price Canyon, San Luis Obispo. Neither of those things is actually an AVA. It's allowed to use the county name.
Okay.
Because that's a part of California law. So it uses San Luis Obispo. The most specific AVA that it actually falls into is Central Coast. That encompasses Paso Robles and Santa Barbara. And those places are not that close to one another. The vineyard management company is doing the petitioning they told me that they've been working for about 6 years and they're close to approval for what they're calling San Luis Obispo Coast AVA or SLO Coast.
Hmm.
Which should be, I mean, that'll be interesting.
Yeah.
I think the important parts about, you know, the vineyard are that it's super duper close to the ocean, that it's cool climate. This wine almost gave me the impression that it was acidified, but I don't think that it was.
Is that the addition of acid separate from the acid that comes from the fermentation process? Is this non-native acid?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So the idea being that if grapes come into the winery and let's say the pH is 3.3 and the winemaker wants it at 3.25, they'll add a little bit of tartaric acid to drop the pH.
Does that happen a lot?
Yes. It's usually not perceptible.
Right.
I've tasted some very heavily acidified wines, and there's like a sweet tart kind of like sting right on the tip of your tongue that you can perceive. And this wine almost gave me that perception. I was like almost there, like this is definitely acidified, but then it's like it's not quite on the tip of the tongue, and it's not really saccharine the way sweet tarts are.
Yeah.
And that coupled with the green notes makes me think this was just very early harvest.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, it's got good acid. It's got a little bit of greenness to it. It's really fresh. It's really easy. This is a wine that doesn't necessarily need to be pontificated about, except for the great mystery of who the fuck makes it.
Who makes it? Would you cellar this? Because in my reading about Chardonnay, I've seen that. In fact, no, they say it on the bottle. It's good from now. I had the 2019 vintage, and on the bottle they said, drink between now and 2024.
Right.
So they're recommending cellaring 4 to 5 years. What happens if you go beyond that? Will it just get nasty if you drink it in 2028?
I don't think it'll be. I think this wine will hold up. But yeah. I think what's enchanting, what I like about this wine is the youthful bits.
Youthful bits.
So the greenness.
Green is young.
Yes.
Green is underripe.
Correct.
Which is less old, which is more young.
Yes. Let's go with that.
But is that why you said youthful?
Yes.
Because green means more ripe.
But also the...
Or less ripe.
The sort of... How do I quantify this? There's something or about...
Or qualify it too. Either one.
Or qualify either way.
Yeah.
Jerk. Yeah, qualify is the correct word.
I know. You're right. You're welcome. Yeah.
Dick.
Johnny Words up in here.
Where is Johnny Words?
I don't know. He's...
Friend of the pod, Johnny Words.
Friend of the pod, Johnny Words. Johnny Words, yet to leave us a review.
Fucking...
Go fuck yourself, Johnny Words.
Fuck you, Johnny Words. All right. There's something about the aromatics on this wine...
That are young.
Because this wine is not highly aromatic, but it does have a sort of sparkle to it.
A nose sparkle?
Yeah.
It's not aromatic, but it does have a nose sparkle.
Yes. I know.
Come on, man. You're giving me less to go on than usual. What even is that? It's not aromatic. I had some smelling notes. I had a couple of good sniffing notes.
It definitely has aroma to it, but it's not like a Sauvignon Blanc that like explodes out of the glass and you can like I could hold the glass, you know, feet from my face and still smell it.
Okay.
This wine, you have to like put your nose in the glass. But once you get your nose in the glass, it's that, I guess it's the fruit character in the sea breeze.
Is youthful,
yeah.
Okay.
And then once you age it for a little while longer, the fruit character might be a little bit more muted. You might still say green apple, but it wouldn't stand out to you.
It wouldn't be as tart. And what do you gain? So the fruit becomes more muted. Does anything else get bigger?
Well, ideally something else does, but I don't think that this wine is particularly set up to age.
Okay.
In a more deep, serious Chardonnay... You would start to get like walnut husk. The like spice notes would begin to be a little bit more pronounced. Spice notes from oak aging.
Uh-huh.
This one was made deliberately in stainless steel for early consumption.
Uh-huh.
And I think after 2024, you're just facing diminishing returns.
Okay, so there is a downside to you can oversell or something.
Oh yes.
Yeah. But this, I feel like many of the wines we've done on this show, you tend to, is it because of the cost? Because of like the price tag that we've tried to, like the ceiling we've tried to keep on the show, that things tend to be, I feel like you're saying a lot that we should just drink this now. This wine is meant to be drunk right now.
Yes. And I also, I mean, I'm choosing wine for me to drink.
Right.
I want it to be in the fucking drinking window.
Right.
You know, okay. We want people to be able to purchase it. And I also want people to enjoy it now.
Yeah. We have a game to be played, Jamie.
Yes.
The game must be played.
The game must be played.
No, we have done a Chardonnay previously, but in that episode, we didn't play the game. Because someone had convinced me that the game wasn't fun, and that it sucked, and that we shouldn't do it anymore. So for episode 5, when we did Widows and Chardonnay, I just didn't do it. And then only after that did I start editing the first 5 episodes, and when I realized, oh right, the game is great, and I have good instincts as a radio producer. And so now it's just not going away ever.
Okay, so we get to do our first Chardonnay game.
Jamie! Oh, I shouldn't be clapping. Do the emoji thing where you clap between all the words that I say. Jamie versus Wine Folly. 5 principal flavors of Chardonnay. I'm going to tell you right now, she's not separating here between oaked and stainless. So it's just Chardonnay.
Yep.
Do you have 5 principal flavors for Chardonnay? Jamie, begin. Go right now.
I think we're going to go with Macintosh Apple. Valencia Orange. No. Strike that. Pineapple. Vanilla. Cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
S-I-N. Amin.
Oh, man. I love Turtle Puss.
Oh, man. Friend of the pod, Turtle Puss.
Friend of the pod.
If you're out there.
KTP, Kid S-I-N. Turtle Puss.
That's funny to nobody.
No. No, that's all getting cut.
I think you should keep it in just because it's
fun. He might be listening.
I'm sure he's listening. He loves us.
Yeah, we do get some LA listens.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He out there.
Anyway, Macintosh Apple, Pineapple, Vanilla, S-I-N, Amin, and...
I'm going to go with Guava.
Guava. Sure. Okay. So, fine. Let's do a drum roll. I don't know.
You for making fun of me for saying guava. All
right.
Just because right. You don't have any idea what guava tastes like.
I have no idea what guava tastes like. Do we eat guava?
I eat guava.
Guava is a fruit, right?
Guava is a fruit.
And
yes,
it's green on the outside and yellow on the inside?
It's more like peach colored on the inside.
Boy, that's not at all what I thought a guava looked like. I just Googled guava. Wow. Yeah. It looks like a watermelon. Anyway, so drum roll, please, I guess. Winefolly.com. Jamie said the top five flavor notes would be for Chardonnay, Macintosh apple, pineapple, vanilla, cinnamon, and guava. Drum roll now. Wine Folly says vanilla, pineapple, yellow apple, star fruit, and butter.
Butter.
I'm really surprised you didn't say butter, because even I know Chardonnay is oaky butter. So you got 2 out of 5.
I'm actually disappointed in myself that I didn't.
I'm disappointed in you too, as I am every time we play this game.
F*** you, buddy.
Just saying, you could have done better. So that's Wine Folly this week. Guava?
Guava.
Is guava similar to starfruit? I've had starfruit.
They're pretty different flavors, but they're but like the tropical family of fruits, the pineapple, the guava, the passion fruit, the starfruit, the kiwi.
Yeah.
Those are all sort of present in Chardonnays that I've had. And I'm not defending myself. Obviously, I got it wrong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. But, you did. But you also didn't try, so you don't care.
I tried. I actually, that was.
Did you try to guess what Wine Folly was going to say?
I did, yeah. That's why I put vanilla and cinnamon in there, because those aren't varietal characters. Those are oak characters.
Right. And butter. But the butter flavor comes from the oak. And a lot of inferior Chardonnay makers use oak to tease out the cream and butter flavors to hide other things. I did a cursory amount of research today.
I'm really proud of
it. I think it seems like I've processed it incorrectly.
Butter comes from malolactic conversion.
Not malolactic fermentation.
Well, people call it malolactic fermentation, but it's not a fermentation.
But it's not a fermentation. It's a conversion.
It's carried out by bacteria called Enococcus eni, and it produces... It changes malic acid into lactic acid, and in the process, a chemical called diacetyl, which smells like butter.
Jamie, I listened to our 5th episode in which we discussed Chardonnay and widows. Very few other people did. I'm very disappointed in you, by the way, listening audience. I'm looking at the microphone now to make direct eye contact.
I was going to make note.
Widows. We know that the movie side is driving this, everybody, okay? Nobody's going to not listen to the episode if they can't get the Clo Julien, but if they're like, I'm not going to watch that movie, I have a feeling many, not all, people would not listen.
Yeah, Widows was a disappointment on the listenership end, and
I will never forgive our listenership.
We're blaming you fuckers. Like, watch that fucking movie.
Just watch Widows.
Widows is great.
I blame Fox as well. And Disney.
Fuck you, Fox and Disney.
Yeah. All right.
Pairing.
Pairing. I'm going to just jump right in and say, I think it kind of works. I think your initial note that the pairing didn't work because the wine was too understated, I think is like kind of true. But in the way that you said that the wine is a little bit thoughtful, it's medium minus thoughtful.
Yes.
I think that in that level, how you describe it is youthful.
Right.
Right. That youthful, there's... Although it's not sweet. I said unexpectedly sweet. You ignored sweet. And it's got, we think it's maybe got the candy rainbow. It's got the fruit flavors, but not the glitter bomb.
Right.
But I think there is warmth to it.
I think so too.
Infectious enthusiasm. I don't know if this is an enthusiastic wine. It's not very loud. Lambrusco maybe. Is Lambrusco an enthusiastic wine?
Lambrusco is super enthusiastic. Actually, like a rosé Lambrusco.
Is that a thing?
Yeah. I gave you a bottle of it one time.
I probably drank it.
You definitely drank it. That has a little bit of sweetness to it, that would have been a really great pair. But I think you keyed into what I think about the pairing, which is that neither this movie nor this wine demand anything of you or demand much from you. They are experiences that are...
They're both very drinkable. Eurovision is something that I can imagine watching a bunch of times very easily, very casually. I could just throw it on and breeze through it. And this wine, like... I just finished a glass. I'm going to go open up another bottle when we're done. Like, it's... And, like, I've had some Chardonnays that are less drinkable that feel like maybe there's a little bit of work you have to put into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it lets you come to it, but it's super easy, I thought.
I agree. And that is why, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, why I have such fond memories of this wine is just, like, buy a couple of bottles and kind of get tanked. You know, it's not oaky buttery Chardonnay. It's not cougar juice. But it is...
Wow. That's not a nice thing to say.
I worked at a steakhouse in King of Prussia.
I'm familiar. I went there once and I understood your misery.
Did I ever tell you about the woman who was a regular who actually had a cougar tattooed on her back.
Wow.
Like a full back tattoo.
Wow.
And she would always wear like a backless something. This woman, like late 40s, early 50s, would walk in and you're like, this is a very elegant looking woman. And then she would turn around.
Full back.
And tattoo. You would just hear in your head like the.
Like the most cliche sound effect of a cougar roaring.
She would come in and walk out with a like 20 something guy every night.
Wow. Good for her.
I mean, she was out there killing the game, drinking, unsurprisingly.
Chardonnay. Yeah. Cougar juice.
That's right.
What else do we have to say about the pairing?
Not a lot. I mean, the wine's easy to drink. The movie goes down easy too. And I think on that level it works. I think I failed in really paying attention to what you said.
Sugar. There's no, it's not
unexpectedly sweet. Which, like, I think I was aiming at, rather than it being a sweet wine, having like fruit character and that being unexpected, but I failed.
Yeah.
Glitter Bomb Candy Rainbow, like, I don't know what the fuck I was doing. It should have been a Pet Nat. It should have been a Lambrusco. It should have been something with bubbles. Something more effusive and aromatic and fun.
Yeah, because this wine, like, looked like I drank it. I drank most of a bottle while I was watching the movie. I never had, like, the synesthetic spark.
Right.
I think they go well together, but I don't know that the wine brought anything to the movie experience.
No, and the only thing that, and credit to your wife for trying on this one, the sea breeze note going with the fact that they're next to the ocean a bunch.
Yeah. Yeah, she's trying to help you out. I feel like if the movie was more of what I feel like a lot of us expected it to be, like if the movie was more of a Will Ferrell parody of Eurovision, maybe the pairing would have worked better.
You think?
Yeah, because there's so much, there's that bitterness, right? The bitterness that I called green apple, that you called, I don't know, something else. You described the bitterness as something else.
Lemon pith and crab apple.
The lemon pith and crab apple, sure, definitely. But yeah, if the thing had more of a bite, like the movie doesn't have a bite. It doesn't have, there's no targets.
There's
in the
no
movie.
Bite at all.
There's
just
no
it's,
target.
It's nice to every character and it's nice to the audience.
Yeah. Even Eric, who is like the louse who everybody always jokes that he's probably like fathered half the town. And then he goes out and he's just like, it's what Pierce Brosnan does now. Like he shows up in a beard and he's super hot and in his 60s. And he just like plays a sleaze who like fucks and is, you know, unreliable. And even he gets not just redemption, but like emotional catharsis at the end by like inspiring his son. Like you got back on that stage. You didn't let it like, you know, he made him proud. Like even that character who you could just write off and him be a shitty father. Like everybody gets that full journey.
It's both him and Lemtov.
Yeah.
Like they are the easy targets and they end up not being, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah. And it was like, it was a perfect 2020 movie because it's so like contrapuntal to 2020. Yes. Like a lot of great 2020 movies, like next time when we talk about the movie we talk about for next episode, is a 2020 movie for like all the bad ways and the ways where it's like, oh, this was made last year and that you just knew that we were all going to be trapped in our houses and going fucking crazy like that. Or like Defy Bloods is a great 2020 movie because of the themes and the events that it was speaking to, right? And this is a salve of a 2020 movie, essentially.
It is.
Because it's like, it's people together in large groups and at arenas enjoying music together and feeling a sense of global community. Like it's everything that no one was having last year at all.
So final take on the wine. Well, we already did.
Wine good.
I like the wine too.
I liked it. You liked it. I think, and we both obviously love the movie. Everybody should watch the movie.
And final take on the pairing is like meh. It works because it's a thing to drink.
Yeah.
And they're both easy, but it's not.
Yeah, there's nothing magic. They're not sparking together, and they don't really reflect each other in any like revealing or interesting ways. But the wine is super nums. And you think what do you call it? A Lambrusco or a Pet Nat would have been better?
I think so. Like I said, I think the Cachique Maravilla that we had for the Oscars episode.
Yeah.
That would have been a really good.
That was fucking weird.
Good choice. It was a weird wine, but this is a weird movie. Okay, right,
so
next time on.
Next time on, we're back on the flipskies.
Yes.
Where Jamie picked a wine.
I chose a wine. I chose Chateau Vieilla. Chateau Vieilla, V-I-E-L-L-A. It's their tradition bottling from an area called Matarán in southwest France, and it is 100% Tannat.
Tannat. What does that mean?
Tannat is a grape. It's famously, its claim to fame is that it is supposedly the most tannic variety in the world.
Oh, this could work out pretty well.
Yeah.
This could work real well.
I'm feeling good about the descriptors that I gave you. The descriptors that I gave you for this wine are big, dark, powerful, refined, and constructed.
That's very specific. This is a good pairing. So hang on. So this Chateau Vieille, yes. Tradition, Tannat, Moore Brothers.
Moore Brothers Wine Company. It was in the $20 range.
$20 range.
All right. Can't remember specific. It might have actually been 18.
Well, to that I paired, to big, dark, powerful, refined, and constructed, I picked yet another of my favorites of 2020, which is a little movie called She Dies Tomorrow. This is written and directed by Amy Simons. She's an actor and a director and a writer, and she works on crews, and she's huge in the American independent scene. This is her second feature. She's directed a couple of shorts. Amy Simons is great. And the movie is available on Hulu. And I'm just kind of like straight up warn people, this movie is intense and it's heavy and it's difficult. And if you struggled with things like isolation or anxiety or depression during 2020 as a result of the pandemic or just in general, you might want to take a pass on this week, and I begrudge no one.
I struggled with all of those things.
Yeah.
But I don't get to take a pass.
No, you have to watch the movie.
God damn it.
And you'll probably watch it twice. I don't even know how to describe the plot. The basic premise is, what if someone could incept, like in Inception, right? Like the idea of like subconsciously putting a pervasive thought in someone's brain.
Incept. I understand what you meant based on the Rick and Morty usage.
Okay,
of
yes.
It. We're so, incepting.
Right, we're incepting. Just like everyone's favorite movie.
It's a shitty movie.
What? That movie's pretty good.
It sucks.
It's really good.
Fuck you.
Our Tenet episode's going to be awesome. It's going to be so great. What if you were so anxious that you became convinced that you were going to die the next day? And then what if, simply by suggestion, you could incept that idea into another person? And then what if this idea became a disease that spread?
Oh, dear God.
It is big. It is dark. It is extremely powerful. The filmmaking is confrontational, but like refined and immaculate. Narrative and temporal construction and the visual construction. This is going to be, I think, a great pairing. And the movie is outstanding, and I highly recommend it. But it is heavy and very difficult. It is also a beautiful 85 minutes long. I'm a big fan of the 85 minute movie. But so She Dies Tomorrow on the Hulu, available now. Please check it out and enjoy. And if people want to like talk about it, just like DM the show, DM me, and like I'm happy to talk about it, tell you what I think it's about and what it means, and you know, walk people through the experience. It is the least accessible movie that we have talked about on the show thus far.
Well, I'm really glad that I'm not specifically right now going through a difficult personal time.
Yeah, you'll be fine. It's fine. It's fine. So that's next time. Let's wrap it up, Jamie. Let's put a button on it. I ain't got nothing else. Wait, plugs. Do we have plugs? Do you have anything you want to share with the humans?
I did this not last time, but the time before, plugging another podcast. But a friend of mine from Canada has started a wine podcast with a colleague of hers. They're doing a podcast about Canadian wine. If anyone who's listening to this show is also the kind of insufferable nerd that I am and wants to know more about a region that is oft maligned, check out the VQA podcast.
VQA, like Victor Quiet Alpha.
For the podcast, alpha. It's spelled V-Q-E-H.
VQA, Canadians, it's A. Right. That's good.
VQA with an actual A is like the legal designation by which Canadian wines are labeled.
They're like Canadian appellations.
Right. Okay. So it's a pun on VQA.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's clever.
Anyway, Tash is awesome. I've listened to their first two episodes. Her and her podcast partner are really engaging. And the second episode about Niagara sparkling wine had me really interested to get some. So if you're interested, that's VQEH on basically all the podcatchers.
Nice. VQEH. I love it. The thing that has been absolutely captivating my eyes and my brain the last several days. I have been watching Barry Jenkins' The Underground Railroad on the Amazon Prime. This is an Amazon original series based on the Colson Whitehead novel from a few years ago, The Underground Railroad, that tells the story of a runaway slave in the antebellum South who finds herself on a literal underground railroad that whisks her slowly away to the North. And there's elements of like myth and epic and almost magical realism. Like there's heightened, not quite fantasy elements to it. But it's also a story about slavery in the South, and it is extremely brutal and utterly unflinching in its depiction of violence. But it's also just, it's Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk. It is the most beautifully photographed thing. The performances are great. The score by Nicholas Britell is just fucking outstanding. Like it's a 10-hour movie, and that's normally a thing I think is stupid and that people shouldn't say, but like it actually feels like it. It's the, what is it? What does the one Supreme Court justice say about pornography? I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
Yes.
This is cinema. Like I could define it, but I know it when I see it. And this is
cinema.
This is not TV.
Yeah, you've recommended this to me. I need to just fucking watch it because it seems kind of up my alley. But maybe I'm not going to start it before the She Dies Tomorrow episode, so that I don't spiral into a depressive into episode.
Despair. Yeah, that would be poor. But yeah, so The Underground Railroad, directed by Barry Jenkins on the Amazon Prime, highest recommendation with the largest possible trigger warning for lots of people.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you for joining us. It has been, and I hope will always be, a pleasure. Follow us on all the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com if you've got any questions. Make sure to rate, review, and follow.
We say follow now. Vocab guidelines mandate that we say follow.
Rate, review, and follow. And remember to drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you.
I agree. And yeah, if you found this in-person recording uncomfortable or stilted or strange or in any way not like our usual show experience, you're not alone. Please feel free to send your comments, feedback, and thoughts. If you think that Jamie and I should not be in person to record these things, I'm really not used to this amount of sustained eye contact. It's very weird. It's weird, guys. All right. Enjoy, everyone. Thanks for listening. Thanks for drinking. Thanks for watching movies. Play Ya Ya Ding Dong. We didn't talk about Ya Ya Ding Dong.
God damn it.
Can Ya-Ya I give you the last Ding thing Dong. About Ya Ya Ding Dong? The actor who plays the guy who screams, play Ya Ya Ding Dong, was invited to... So the real Eurovision just happened like a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
The 2021 version, which I think they still referred to as the 2020 version. He was invited. He was the official Icelandic like announcer of points. The guy who like gets on TV and tells everybody what Seriously? The points were. And he 12 points to Ya Ya Ding Dong. Play Ya Ya Ding Dong. And apparently he took it too far. They had to coax him along and get him to get back on point and just stop screaming Ya Ya Ding Dong.
Also, Ya Ya Ding Dong, the song, amazing.
Great song.
And just about a penis.
Yeah, it's just
a song about dick.
Yeah.
My love for you is growing wide and long, Scott.
Okay. Well, we're going back to virtuals next time, everybody.